Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for a bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney, and Republican factotum, Jay Carson. How are you doing today, Jay?
I'm doing good, Mike.
So, you know, it's been a few weeks since we've done a listener mail comment episode. Are you ready for one today?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, let's just launch right into it then. Starting with Tom from Wilmington, North Carolina. And Tom writes, I'm listening to your last podcast and I felt a need to comment. The right has somehow captured the imagination of the public that the Mueller investigation is a collusion investigation. It's not. That isn't even a thing. The referral order is entitled Appointment of Special Counsel to Investigate Russian Interference with the 2016 Presidential Election and Related Matters. Although it includes investigation of any links and or coordination between the Russian government and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump, it specifically allows investigation of any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation and gives the special counsel authorization to prosecute federal crimes arising from the investigation. So, did Russia interfere and how? Mueller's investigating this right now. Good thing someone is. We've already seen people in the Trump orbit fall for money laundering and obstruction, and more indictments will follow. There's a lot of hand-wringing about Rod Rosenstein possibly being fired and how this would hamper the Mueller investigation, but I think that given Mueller's independent charging authority, he's good to go. Trump would have to move after Mueller directly to shut down the investigation. I don't think he will do this, but if he does, the concern is that Republicans won't object or will applaud the action. Jay? So Tom throws it to you.
Oh, he's throwing it. Yep. Is that coming from you or coming from...
No, that's coming from Tom.
I think he's pretty much exactly... Tom, you're exactly right on all that. To the extent this has been characterized as a collusion investigation, my sense is that's not coming from the right. That's coming from the left.
And the president.
So much of the, well, and the president, fair enough. This is more the idea that Trump somehow colluded. Again, I don't think most Republicans appointed Mueller or wanted Mueller appointed for that purpose. But everything else Tom says is right on as far as look his authority and his scope to do this. My concern, and I raised this at the beginning, and I think it's a concern that everybody ought to share, is when you have these sort of situations. And again, Mueller has more reins on him than, say, an independent counsel would. But these investigations can run fairly far afield and go for years, and it sort of becomes a sinecure of sorts for the prosecutor and his staff. And there's no reason to stop investigating things because you've always got a staff, you've always got a salary. There's always something to find. So I agree also that Trump trying to fire Mueller, either directly or indirectly, would be a very bad move. I don't think most Republicans would approve of that. If not from a, you know, just the, even if there were cause to fire him, it would certainly look so bad politically and be so damaging that you wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So, Tom, I don't really disagree with you.
You know, I wanted to except
to the point that the collusion, again, that's been more a Democrat top talking point that's what needs to be investigated. Yeah. So.
Well, I think, and as I mentioned, it's certainly how Donald Trump sees it, but I think that's because Donald Trump can't help but see everything as revolving around him and being incredibly personal. That's how he is. And, you know, I'll give him a tiny bit of credit for finally, far belatedly, coming out and saying that yes, the Russians did in fact attempt to influence our elections, and we're doing stuff about it. I think that only came obviously after a lot of publicity in recent weeks with, you know, Mike Rogers testifying to the Senate Intelligence Committee that we weren't really doing anything and that sort of thing. I think that sort of pushed him along those lines, but I think it's incredibly difficult for him to do it. And someone made a great point recently. I forget exactly who this person was, but he said, we have a very unfortunate combination here in Donald Trump. you have an incredibly powerful man who's also incredibly insecure. That's a disastrous, at least a disaster in the making combination. And, you know, I think a lot of what President Trump does stems from his deep, deep insecurity and the massive chip he has on his shoulder. And that's, you know, we talk about, you know, character and that sort of thing and how much it matters in terms of a leader. Well, I think there are certain traits like that, deep insecurity that you just simply do not want in a hugely powerful individual. And that's one of many reasons why I think that Donald Trump is just one of the last people you would want to be in this position that he's in right now. And I think this just sort of shows up in the Russia investigation.
But here we are.
Here we are. All right, moving on. Ryan writes, listening to your most recent podcast and your discussion about healthcare in the United States, I think both of you have missed out on an important point.
Uh-oh.
Oh, here we go. At least it's bipartisan, Jay. He says, Harvard has done ongoing studies on bankruptcy in the United States, and consistently, the largest cause between 50 and 60%, depending on the year and study, of personal bankruptcy in the United States is healthcare costs associated with major illnesses. This is an issue unique to the United States and should be troubling to anyone discussing this issue. Another point that I think has been missed is that universal healthcare does not necessarily preclude you from choosing your doctor, paying for quicker treatment, or purchasing additional insurance for covering private medical care. This is the case in many countries, such as Australia. And I think it's a fallacy to state that the market would not influence care when moving to a universal system. Well, Brian, I absolutely agree. We certainly haven't talked about the personal bankruptcy issue and how big a part of it healthcare is. And it is something that is, we see this in the United States like we see nowhere else, in part because our healthcare system, I think, is so incredibly broken. And in terms of universal healthcare existing with supplemental insurance, you're right, that happens in another places. It's not a simple either or then type of thing, but I think so often in our debates on these things, it artificially simplifies to look at either or, and so that's what people do. But as you pointed out, in more than just Australia and a number of other places, that there exists sort of a hybrid type model, and I would certainly like to see us move to something like that, though politically, I don't see that as happening anytime soon. Jay?
Ryan, I think you're right on the first point, and I disagree with you on the second. That being, I think looking at health expenses as a factor in bankruptcy is a big deal, and I think it's a good argument for basic catastrophic insurance. Which is exactly sort of one of the types that you weren't able to buy in the Obamacare exchanges and insurers weren't able to provide. And that's the type that would be good for younger, healthy people who might come down with either, again, some disastrous accident or a very serious, long-term medical condition. I think that's absolutely a problem, and if we can help fix healthcare insurance issues, you help fix bankruptcy issues, and that's good for everyone in the economy. But I disagree that a universal payer or single payer is the correct response for a number of reasons. I think that there was something I posted on the website last week. In the Washington Post, because I'm trying to read more Washington Post kind of stuff, just to broaden my horizons.
And it was one of these, right? Sorry.
Yes, on the Facebook page, and it was also sort of a silly headline about doctors who are refusing a raise
in Canada, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yes, and to me, that when you read the entire story, they sort of buried the lead. The reason these doctors are refusing a raise is because they're sort of standing in solidarity with nurses and other health professionals who are, they believe, being underpaid and overworked. And the article goes on to talk about the problems that Canada is experiencing with this underpayment and overwork proposals to limit the number of patients that nurses could see in a single day, et cetera. And the other word for that essentially is rationing. And I think that's what happens when you get to these a single payer system, you know, eventually care will suffer. There's only so much money to be had, and it can only go so far.
Sure.
So that's where I would disagree with you, and I think a lot of these systems, which we look to and say, oh, they're great because it's single payer and the government takes care of everything. If you look a little bit deeper, they're struggling and they've had problems and will continue to have problems. So,
you know, on the rationing point, I would counter that healthcare is inevitably be rationed. The question is, on what basis will it be rationed? Right now, it's a ration on the ability to pay in many instances, and I think that's a fundamentally unfair thing. But you're certainly right that this is just what other countries have adopted. By the way, almost every other country, advanced industrial country except the United States, has adopted some method where ability to pay is not the primary criteria for rationing. And I think that's, or having a job. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But that being said, you know, I think, Jay, that you and I agree at least on some fundamental things here. Number one, that we have serious problems with the healthcare market in the United States. And number two, that if we could somehow have, I don't know, a transparent and competitive market for basic, for the wide range of healthcare sure. services, that would be the best possible outcome. You and I think, are in.
Yeah. And that the issue we have so often is that there are these, I don't know, anomaly isn't the word I'm looking for.
Well, I think this is where we disagree, actually, because I think you and a lot of conservatives believe that we actually can create this sort of competitive system, and that we can essentially find a way that healthcare can be a market. There can be a market for healthcare like for many other goods. And where a lot of liberals like myself disagree is to say, no, healthcare is simply too fundamentally different. That's why essentially every other advanced rich country in the world has moved away from this system, and we should too. And that's, I think, where the fundamental disagreement is. So it's basically, you know, you conservatives against us liberals and the rest of the world. So it's a lonely fight that you're fighting here, I think.
We few, we happy few.
Yeah, something yeah. like that. All right. Moving on. Next is Matthew from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Matthew writes, let me say first that I haven't been listening long, but I've been loving what you do. Oh, thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Matthew.
As someone, of course, as someone who is liberal, more so than Mike, but tries to search for pragmatic and moderate solutions to issues, you all provide a welcome respite from the partisan bickering that typically surrounds me. I admit to choosing to listen to some of it, but I can't help but find that Pod Save America crew, that's a very liberal kind of podcast, a lot of listeners I'm sure are familiar with it, to be a little funny. I recently started supporting you on Patreon because I believe in what you do. Thank you again, Matthew. We appreciate that. I currently work as an accountant at a university, but I'm working toward a degree in public policy, so you can likely guess I'm a junkie for the types of conversations you have. What I wanted to respond to, though, was from your episode regarding the correspondence about Susan Jacoby. She was the author I interviewed about the Age of American Unreason.
Right.
And Matthew says, I feel like something was being missed in the conversation about all of that, and I felt the need to chime in. Susan makes a good point that we don't need to respect the beliefs of others, and I agree with that. However, if we intend to engage with people from the other side in a civil manner, we need to show the people respect. When we make signs of contempt, we may see it as nothing, but because the beliefs of people are a part of their identities, it is perceived as contemptuous toward the person. When we don't show respect to the other person, that is when communication will break down. So, Jay, I'm betting you agree with that.
Absolutely. Matthew, that is a fantastic point, and I'm glad you made it.
Well, you know, I agree, but I guess I understand sort of where some folks are coming. What if, in fact, you have actual contempt for someone's use? How do you go forward there? How do you engage? And I think that can be very difficult. I mean, there are certainly people you can say, well, I respect your right to have this view, which I feel is wrong, but there are some people who we feel have views that are contemptible.
Sure,
I feel
sure,
that way about white nationalists, for interesting.
Right.
And so I guess I would argue there are certain instances, there are certain people that you can't productively engage, and you shouldn't try to do that unless you're starting to start a fight, basically. But I'd also like to think that those people are still at the fringes of society. And there are people who maybe you just shouldn't bother engaging, shouldn't waste your time. Because if you do, oftentimes that just provides them a platform. But that doesn't, you know, again, most people aren't like that. But I don't think the thing like with a Richard Spencer, someone like that, comes to your university. I don't think the response that makes sense to me is to shut them down and riot and so forth. The response that makes sense to me is to just ignore them. Because what Amen. People like this thrive on is the conflict and the controversy and the media attention. And the worst thing you can do, the most damaging thing you can do to them, is just go, whatever. That is, that deprive them of the oxygen that they need to put out their toxic views. That's what we can do. But it's so hard to do, and I appreciate that. But I think that's the proper response. That's my view.
Yeah, and I get, you know, there's always that judgment call of, do I let this noxious view, this true hatred, go unchallenged? And you know, there's always the, well, you know, if people had, you know, challenged you know, the Nazis earlier on or something, that things might have been different. But I think by and large, I would agree with Mike's approach that there's some folks that you can't engage with. But for the Susan Jacoby point, again, I think it's exactly right. She can respect or not respect whoever she wants. But if the argument is why won't these people engage? And this, again, comes back to sort of these the Democrat lament of you know, these racist morons won't vote for us. Vote for us, you racist morons. You know, that, and to me, that the question kind of came up in that context, is that she thought there were a large swath of people who are not white nationalists or racist or somehow other really out of the you know, on the fringe, that she would just sort of write off. That, again, that's why we got Trump.
I think there are people that you can write off on certain issues, but you don't necessarily have to write them off entirely. You know, for instance,
sure,
I find that so many of these so-called debates between the new atheists and believers to be entirely pointless. You know, when people are dealing with articles of faith, whether they're with religion, sure, or any other thing, and you know, you can hold things as articles of faith without talking specifically about religion, people feel that way about many public policy issues. It's really, there's no point in debating. There, just leave it alone and find, you know, another issue to engage on. Maybe.
Well, I guess. I mean, there could be a point to the extent it's educational for those watching it.
I guess. But you know,
you may have people two people who are not going to move on either side. But if they are respectful of one another and they can make good arguments, pro and con, that's a good thing for you know, democracy, for our society.
No, that's a fair point. I think just too often.
But if it's a, you know, God exists, no, he doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's less informative.
Well, I think in too many cases, it just ends up being two people talking past each other.
You know? Yeah.
But all right. Well, see, next we have Maureen, who emailed to comment about, Jay, about your belief that, I think might have been the last episode, that there should be nationwide concealed carry reciprocity. She writes, carry laws should be banned. It's unsafe to everyone. To state that the rights of states should be overrun by our Constitution is dishonest manipulation of his conservative stance. Get honest, Jay.
Wow. Well, I guess I'll take the first point. If you look at the data that we've got from when concealed carry laws started being passed about 25 years ago, at the time the prediction was this was going to be gunfights in the street. It was going to be the Wild West. It was going to be this horrible society, and really that has not come to pass. In fact, I think by and large, what you've seen in these states with concealed carry is reductions in certain types of crime. You can have your opinion that it's terrible and dangerous, but I don't think the evidence bears that out. Secondly, in terms of of a states' rights argument. Look, I get it. Sure, I would believe that states have the right to have control over a great deal of their public policy. But there is the full faith and credit clause that says if you've got essentially a licensed piece of paper, court ruling, something like from another state, it's going to be given credit in other states. Now, if you're talking about a type of reciprocity where one could import the state law of, say, Vermont, which was a shall issue. No education requirements, so forth. They had a law that goes back to sort of, you know, colonial times. That you want a gun, you got a gun. To say that could be imported to other states, I would agree with you. No, that would not be appropriate under our Constitution. But I would also argue that someone who is driving through a state and is carrying should not be prosecuted criminally if they have a valid license to carry from another state. I think the devil would be in the details of a reciprocity bill. But I think the way this came up, it was sort of Mike said, what do you think? Would you support something like that? And I said, sure. This isn't something I'm out there marching for, yeah. But I'm not opposed to it, and I think it could be drafted in a way that's both constitutionally sound and respectful of states' rights, states' police power.
You know, and actually, given that sort of more detailed explanation than you were able to get into last time, I actually see what you're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree. I guess maybe I'm a little more willing to consider that, given where I live. I live in Cincinnati, which of course is right across, right across from Kentucky. And in fact, I work in Kentucky, and so I cross state lines all the time. And so I could sort of see wherein, depending on how you crafted a law in limited instances like that, where some sort of very limited reciprocity, you can make a reasonable case for. Now, as a general rule, I'm just against concealed carry laws as a general thing. And now,
sure, but that's that's a separate.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I would say that the research that's been done on them, you can find individual studies to say a whole bunch of things. Now, a little while ago, the Rand Institute, the Rand Corporation did a meta-analysis and found basically that the evidence was uncertain about the effects of concealed carry laws on violent crime. And yet, to me, this is another great example of why we need more and better research on this sort of thing, because this is an important public policy question. And we're just not putting enough time and effort, I don't think, into funding this sort of thing. You know, this is a huge, obviously, gun deaths, gun violence, a huge problem in the United States. And in many other issues, when we have huge problems like this that lead to tens of thousands of people being killed every year, we pour a ton of money into looking into it, and we just haven't done that with the gunning issue. And I think that's because it's become so politicized, and because groups like the NRA have taken such a strong stance against even looking at the issue, even researching the issue. And that, to me, is hugely problematic.
Here's what I'd like to see in terms of numbers, and I would bet that they're out there. I haven't looked this up myself. Perhaps others have, and maybe I'll give it a shot in the next couple of days. But I'm curious as to the number, the percentage in states that have concealed carry laws, the number of prosecutions for people with a concealed carry license for gun crime. I'm betting that number is going to be extremely low.
I would be very skeptical of just pulling out a couple numbers like that. I mean, that's why, I mean, I feel.
Well, not just a couple numbers. It's like, okay, how many people have been charged?
Well, yeah, data points.
Did they have a license?
Well, the social scientist in me.
A licensed person committed a gun crime.
The social scientist in me says that you are vastly oversimplifying, thinking that you can come to any conclusions based on that. That's why I like things like meta-analysis, where you have people who do this for a living, and do some fairly sophisticated analysis and you look at a bunch of them. I think that's far more indicative than anything that you or I could do in a few minutes of looking online. And that's why, I mean, again, it seems like the evidence of these from Rand, who are, again, people who do this for a living, is that it's pretty uncertain, pretty inconclusive.
Let me just put this out there, though. If there were a large number of concealed carry licensees who were committing crimes with guns, don't you think we would have heard about it from the media?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, okay.
I would think that, I mean, no, I wouldn't think so. I trust the scientific process. I trust peer review. I trust all these things that as a social scientist, I feel like I understand reasonably well to come at some approximation of what's really going on much better than what I can do in a few minutes of my spare time or what the media is going to tell me.
Okay. So I understand that, but you know, we've got the information that we have access to. I'm just saying, sure. let's take a look at that. And I'm curious as to, have people with concealed carry permits, been, you know, convicted or even charged? Sure. In gun crimes.
Well, and that's a different question. It's a much more limited question. The question I think that most of these studies look at is the effects of concealed carry laws more generally on violent crime. But again, this is not probably.
But I guess I don't want to belabor this because we could do maybe a whole concealed carry show. But what would be the difference, I guess?
Well, again, this would get into a methodological discussion of how you define independent variables, the statistical methods that you use.
Was the person in any given gun crime, of the gun crimes that are recorded in a certain state, how many involved, whether or not they were charged, someone with a concealed carry permit?
Well, here,
wouldn't that be a good number to know?
No, see, here I think this is where, as a non-social scientist, you're vastly oversimplifying. It's just not that simple to do quality research on these things. And that, I think, is why sometimes people reach some unfortunate and incorrect conclusions, because they think that you can just pull out a number or two and that will tell you something. And that's, I just think, just not the case. But again, this probably isn't the forum to get into a methodological debate, I would guess.
All right,
moving on. Let's see. We have something from Luis, who says, I have a simple question. If Jay is a principled conservative, Jay, this is not good for you.
Here we go.
If Jay is a principled conservative, why is he using a derogatory term such as chain migration? The family concept in America is very peculiar, since it includes fewer people than the concept of family around the world. I have cousins who I grew up with that I consider my brothers. I have siblings whose education and upbringing I played an important part in, and I consider them my children. So why change things now? When did this go from a wall to closing doors on honest people of goodwill who just want a chance to become Americans? This doesn't affect me directly because we were all born in the U.S. since my grandparents, but it affects people I care for. Jay?
Well, I guess the first question is this is about, we're talking about someone who comes to the country typically through lottery program and then is able to extend that to all other family members.
Except that's not true. Hold on 1 second. I just want to make clear.
Well, not all other family members.
No, it's only immediate family, and that's not right. Cousins.
As I understand, that's Luis's point, is he thinks it ought to be able to be expanded to beyond that.
Yeah, perhaps right? In part, right. Yeah, I think two points is that doesn't it make sense to have a broader definition? Certainly the Trump administration wants to narrow it even more than it is now. But I think the second part of it is just, you know, the term that you used.
I think that's an accurate term. I mean, it's linking one person's right to come to the country based on their familial relationship with another, rather than them coming here for their own reasons, own merits. That's not to say that they shouldn't come here. They shouldn't be here. We wouldn't welcome them for a whole lot of reasons. But I think change in migration is a perfectly descriptive term of what we're talking about, because what the problem with the lottery visas is it's sold as, hey, we want to invite or allow this person to come. and setting aside the wisdom of choosing your citizens by lottery, you know, then it expands to and these other people. I just don't think it's a rational immigration policy. And if you want to take a look at, well, the U.S. has a more restricted view of what constitutes a family than in other nations and other cultures, you're probably right. That's probably fair enough. But this is the country that is, you know, that the people want to immigrate to, and this is the country that's making the rules, and it's not unreasonable to expect that country to rely on what it views as the definition of a family, as opposed to the definition that's used in some other country. Obviously, if you went by that, it could be essentially meaningless.
Right. So. I'll just make a point about the terminology question. You know, you're right that chain migration is one way to look at it, and that's descriptive in a sense. But I would argue that far more descriptive is the official term that's used, family reunification migration, because that's really what's going on. And I think everyone understands that the word chain is used because it sounds much more harsh and negative, and it's harder to be against family reunification migration than it is to be against chain migration. And so there
are, which is why the drafters chose that title. And of course, Congress would never stoop to using euphemisms to try to sell a policy.
Sure. But I mean, in terms of just describing the policy, this policy is designed to unify, to bring families back together who were broken apart by migration.
I want families' choice to immigrate.
Sure, absolutely. Well, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
I guess that's what I find sort of funny. It's sort of someone, you know, wants to you know, volunteers again for a lottery or not, and however comes to this country, and then somehow claims that their family has been broken apart.
Well, I don't know. People are, you know.
I mean, that's why I thought the unification thing. If you want to unify the family, well, then the one person could always go back to where they.
Go back where you came from, you're saying.
Back where they came from. No, I'm serious. I'm just saying it. This is not some sort of dire thing where the U.S. is breaking up families. And I think that's what sort of there is the idea that when people are deported, for example, you say, oh, they've got a family here, and you're deporting some family members, you're breaking up a family, and that is terrible. And I agree. That's harsh. And in that case, there is a family that's being broken apart. But in this case, it's someone coming from another country who comes here knowing their family's not going to be here, and then complains, where's my family? I just find the family unification term sort of a silly euphemism.
Well, you're completely wrong about that. It's far more descriptive, but you certainly can be wrong about that, and I understand why you would want to call it chain migration. Okay, moving on. Matt writes, as a British resident and listener to your show, I would love to know your thoughts on the current state of UK politics as an American. The state of Brexit, the special relationship, the falling approval rating of Theresa May. I'd love maybe a one-off or bi-monthly UK special, but I appreciate that's a long shot. We've had listeners from
the UK. We get this question a lot.
Well, you know, here's why. Because while nearly 80% of our listeners are from the US, our single biggest non-U.S. contingent is from the U.K. It's around, I mean, it's not huge, but it's around 6%, which is more than anyone else, anywhere else. Yeah, and if, in case you're curious, Canada's number two at 2.9%, Australia, 2.6% of our audience, and then there's Japan at 1.7%, which I wouldn't have necessarily expected, but hi to everyone in Japan. So, you know, I think our response to this has always been fairly consistent, is that while we have sort of a layperson's interest in this, it sort of goes beyond our particular policy expertise, except to say, at least in my view, that I feel that the Trump administration has damaged America's standing in the world, has foregone a number of opportunities to show international leadership, and has set back the reputation and the soft power, if you will, of the United States around the world in so many ways. And I find that to be distressing, not just when it comes to the UK, but to the rest of the world. Jay?
Yeah, I'd say in a lot of ways, yeah, we're just not that smart, not that informed. I know, and I mean that. I'm kind of joking, but you know, to really dig in and have a sort of solid quality opinion on you know, UK politics, we'd have to follow it a lot more closely than we do. And again, we do sort of on a superficial level what's reported in our papers, but that's obviously going to be much less in depth than what's reported over there, and just the experience of living there. I think there's a lot to be said about you get a sense of things based on being there that you just can't yeah. get from reading about it somewhere else. With those caveats, I mean, I'm happy to give sort of my, you know, less informed opinion, and that tends to be that you know, the European Union has kind of bogged down a lot of potential European growth in a bureaucracy that is largely unelected and unaccountable. And I can understand the British desire to step out of the ties that we're binding there. So that's my opinion looking at it from here. As far as Theresa May goes, again, I suppose calling the early election, that was in retrospect not a good call, but I think there are probably so many other issues going on in the UK that I'm not aware of that I'd hesitate to comment further on what's going on with that.
You and I are very much in agreement, though I will point out in sort of responding to your comment about European Union growth and so forth, I will point out that in 2017, the EU actually grew a little bit faster than the United States. Just throwing that out there.
Wow.
So not by much, but by a little bit. So, but yeah, I think in general, we're in agreement on that. So let's see. Next, we have Jody, who writes, "Hi, guys. I was listening to the February 21st show and listening to the medical comparison to Canada. I just wonder why, when any discussion about universal healthcare comes up, how it is that Canada is always a litmus test. Why doesn't anyone say, hey, if you want the government to get involved, then look at the VA system? It's a mess. It's been in the news, and it hits closer to home than Canada. If the VA system is indicative of what you get when government runs healthcare, take a vote. Do you want this, or is the free market better? I would be for having a conversation about what the VA does well, and what improvements are needed, and fashion a system from that. I'm of the mind that I don't want to worry about healthcare. I want to go to a doctor when I need to, have the conversations with my doctor, and take a path that we both can agree on. For instance, maybe I have cancer and I want to go to Disney World with my family. Maybe the best way to do that is not a lot of treatments, but medication that will get me through and create memories with my family, and then I die. But I have a say in the conversation." All right. So, Jay, thoughts on what Jody has to say?
All right, you go, Jody. I think that's a great point to make. Oftentimes we look at Canada just because, one, it's close. Second, it is a national bigger system. And I made the point earlier in regard to that Washington Post article, the Canadian health care system is struggling with containing costs and providing treatment without big weights and overworked and underpaid staff members, which is going to result in lower quality. So I think the VA is a good comparison. I think a lot of times it's tough to maybe make that comparison because the VA is such a smaller system than what a national healthcare system would be, and because it sort of is dealing with a different demographic, many of whom are older and more challenged. So I think that's probably the argument. But you're exactly right. It's federal governing gone wrong. And if you look at even after a year or so of Donald Trump and pledges to clean up the VA, they are still struggling. So
yeah,
and I think that's a good point. And we should also point out, Mike, your mom used to be a volunteer at the VA here in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So,
well, you know,
we salute her for that, but she was doing her best.
She couldn't do enough.
Well, she can't do it all.
No. I guess I would point out that you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. The VA is a mess, continues to be a mess. And I think it's tragic the extent to which we have under-resourced, underfunded the VA and not taken care of so many of our veterans. But I would also say that probably a much better model for a different type of healthcare system is, and I agree with most of your critiques of why the VA isn't that great of a model. I would say would be Medicare. It's a much bigger thing. It's a model that's more in line with sort of, I think,
not providing direct care, exactly, but just providing the payment.
Yeah. And that's a much more likely type of model. And certainly the sort of proposals for a public option competition, a Medicare for all sort of thing, I think those are a lot more likely than an entirely public system like the VA or like the British, national health system, that kind of thing. That's not going to happen in the United States. And so if you take a look at comparisons between Medicare and the private industry, well, there are still some problems with making direct comparisons, but I think that's a system that runs a lot more efficiently and effectively and might be more of a direction, if not like a mandated sort of single payer type of thing, at least as perhaps some sort of public sector competition for private insurance. And I certainly would be in favor of looking at options along those lines.
And Jody is most likely thinking, as am I, and that's how it starts. But
and I would hope so. Yes, exactly.
Thank you for the letter.
If I could get Medicare, if we could get Medicare quality efficiency and care for almost everyone in this country, I would say, let's
and
have that.
Crush the private sector, and then you've got the single payer.
Yeah, well, I'm looking in terms out. But anyway, okay, all right. So that does it for our that empties out our listener. Our listener mail question query mailbag for now. But if you have something, please do. You know how to get in touch with us, mail@politicsguys.com, or you can leave a comment, critique, a rant, a rave, whatever you want on Facebook, our Facebook Politics Guys page. And that's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. You know the deal at this point, I would imagine, everyone. So that does it for us for today. And we hope you like what you heard. Listener support, of course, always super important now that we don't do ads anymore. I know I'm missing some of those Blue Apron meals, but it's worth it. It's worth it, isn't it, Jay? Anyway, so that's politicsguys.com/support. And subscribing to the show also really helps, as does sharing episodes. And it's easy to do, right in whatever podcast app you're using. Just click on the little share symbol and boom, there you go. Word of mouth, much better than anything else for getting the word around. And leaving ratings and reviews in iTunes also does help. All right, the executive producers of The Politics Guys, Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.